There is, one hopes, a little call of the wild left in all of us, even those of us who live in concrete boxes stacked 40 stories high in the city sky. That call leads us to ask, where can we get a taste of wild meat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1389th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Hey, perhaps you're among your friends way down there in Cairns who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, as a baby boomer growing up in Montana's Big Sky, I ate a lot of wild meat. Money was tight just after World War II, and the foods that came wrapped in plastic at the grocery store were too expensive for a family of seven. Fortunately, one grandfather had a farm, so we ate a lot of farm fresh food. The other grandfather had firearms, and game was aplenty. So we hunted antelope and deer, elk, pheasant, and sage hens, and we fished for the beautiful rainbow trout in the tumbling white waters of mountain streams. We ate them all. I now live in the San Francisco Bay Area Metroplex, where the call of the wild food has largely been supplanted by the taste technologies of industrial foods. After all, very few of us city people can afford to hunt and fish, so we eat what comes wrapped in plastic from grocers. Still, one hopes, there is a little call of the wild left in all of us. That call leads us to ask, where can we get a taste of wild meat? Well, who better to ask than Daniel Logner, who is the owner and the butcher of Wild Stag Provisions in Santa Cruz, California. Daniel, welcome to the Food Chain.
It's good to be here.
Good to have you aboard. And let's see, Wild Stag, what is wild meat?
Wild meat.
Yeah, what is in wild meat that is not in cultured meat? There you go.
I like this term wild meat because it gives contradiction to domestic meat, which we use all the time. And while it's not technically wild, because there's some USDA regulations that...
not anything wild anymore, is there, when it gets right down to it.
Yeah, indeed. I like the word wild because it gives a certain image around the type of meat that I source. And it's really focused around the genetic ancestry of the animals that I like to use for my butchering, which are bison, venison, elk, wild boar. And then, depending on the farm and the season, I'll also incorporate rabbit or duck.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found you at the farmer's market. And if there's anything different than wild meat, it's farmer's market meat, farmer's market food, which is cultured, but local. So I was surprised, but then I thought, well, what better place to find wild meat than in a farmer's market? But technically, as a certified farmer's market, you're really not the farmer who grew the food, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm not. I don't own the land or the ranch where my meat comes from.
Okay, good. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how on earth you became a provider of wild meat. I mean, you have quite an academic background, and it would seem like that's the last place you would find a provider of wild meat these days.
Yeah, it's been a long journey. And okay. I have a lot of colorful background, shall we say. But indeed, it started with a love for animals my entire life, and that led me into my academia, which was focused around wildlife and biology. And simultaneously, I built a love for the outdoors, mainly around the outdoor sports, mountaineering, skiing, rock climbing, etc., and just being in the wilderness. To me, being in the wilderness in any modality was deeply fulfilling. And that led me into my later adulthood, my passion for biology and my passion for the outdoor pursuits, and I also felt a lot of connection around trying to be healthy. And that then led me to sourcing my own meat. And the type of hunting that I do requires a lot of skills around being in the wilderness. And it was just natural for me to take my wilderness skills, my biological academic background, and pick up hunting with a very wholesome, mindful way in the backcountry, typically in the high mountains. And then, so that's where my hunting background started. And some years ago, I had a beautiful opportunity to start a new business. And I thought to myself, what would I love to be able to do for myself and for my community? And butchering is, to me, something that I love to do, but also hard work. And I didn't want to take something that I deeply love in the form of a hobby, such as hunting, and turn that into work and monetize that. But I could wrap my head around taking the act of butchering and building some type of business model out of that. And because I know hunting and I know butchering and I love cooking, that was the origin of the seed that's now Wild Stag.
And now it's Wild Stag Provisions.
Provisions, yes.
Very good. Wow, that's quite a story for we city people. Do you see what you're doing with Wild Stag Provisions as kind of challenging city folks with the wild?
I love this question. Because this question, it makes us think about the bigger picture of food in our world and maybe the insulation that we have in cities. There's just such a strong capitalistically driven and individualized structure in society right now that doesn't promote the wholesome consideration of where food comes from and what we should be eating, and also the value of what kind of food actually has. Where if you look back, having a chicken for dinner maybe happened once a week for privileged people, and now we have that 5-6 days a week, and it's not considered frequently where that comes from and what kind of impact that has. And so I like to take the platform of Wild Stag Provisions and shed a little bit of light on the awareness of the value of the life of the animals, the value and the importance of where food comes from, and actually how high of an impact that has. So yes, I like to take, as you call it, city people, and maybe expand their minds a little bit on what they have available and how difficult it actually is to make that available to them all the time.
Well, we city people do have some interesting habits and proclivities. And one of the proclivities we see in a lot of young people is to avoid eating meat and to become vegan or vegetarian or whatnot. And, you know, when I ask why, it's mostly because they don't want to kill an animal, period. And I think that by not wanting to kill and eat animals, they're almost putting society in a place where we will not be able to have animals.
Yeah. Yeah, I would challenge anybody to think a little bit more into the nuance of how things work. And as much as it's nice to consider that vegetarian or veganism is insulated from killing animals, there is, of course, much more complexity to it. And when anybody eats you know, wheat or soy-based products, most of which are supplied for, you know, a lot of vegans and vegetarians eat those types of products, it's often forgotten that those are actually massive habitats for many animals, most of which get killed. And it begs the question that when we live as humans in this world, can we separate ourselves from the cycle of life and death? And I would argue no. And doesn't matter what type of foods you're going to eat, we're inevitably part of the cycle of life and death. What's eating what? Exactly. For us to live, something needs to die. And that goes for vegans and vegetarians as well, as much as it's hard to consider that. And again, there is nuance there. To their credit, they're making a choice that they're trying to stay away from direct access to. So they're avoiding the meat industry and they're trying to avoid direct access into that supply chain. And I commend them for that. But it's also important to consider that they are still causing death out there, that there is still death involved in their food. So it's important to keep those things in mind and think in a multiplicity way as opposed to a binary way. It's not just clean cut.
What place do hunters have in maintaining wildlife?
I love this because it's unfortunately not common knowledge that to anyone who does not hunt, how wildlife in this country is maintained as a resource. There's a structure in the U.S. which has been done extremely successfully called the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. Unfortunately, most people don't know about this unless you're a hunter. And in general, what the model outlines is that each state has their own capacity for managing resources of wildlife, and they will put biologists out into the field, survey what the population is doing, and then make a calculated estimation on how many tags are permitted to be able to be taken, to have the animals taken out by hunters. So each hunter requires a tag for each animal. And those numbers are monitored very closely to ensure that the population can grow. And then there's all kinds of ripple effects, laws that come out of this that permit, that don't permit hunters from selling their meat, things like that, to incentivize hunting. So what ends up happening is that there is money flowing to the state and also the government, but the state, to be able to fund biological surveys. That's coming directly from hunters. And those surveys then allow population estimates to be translated into tags and to promote the population from growing. And it's been shown to be extremely successful, especially in turkeys and black bear, but also elk and deer have come back immensely.
So in effect, it's the hunters who are managing and making possible the wildlife populations.
Almost exclusively.
Wow. So when people look at hunters askance and say you're killing the animals, what you're actually doing is maintaining the population of the animals so they can live.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson today with Daniel Logner. We're looking for a taste of wild meat. Well, come on, admit it. There's a taste, there's a hunger for that call of the wild in all of us. And Daniel is providing that taste. So do stay tuned. We will be right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome. We are back. Michael Olson here with Daniel Logner. We're talking about wild meat. But more than that, we're talking about our relationship with nature and the wilderness and what's left of it. We live in the cities where, you know, a lot of us are living in concrete boxes now, stacked up 40 stories high to the city sky. But there longs in all of us, I think, a taste for that nature. How can we get a taste of it when we live in the city as we do? And that's what Daniel Logner is bringing to us via his Wild Stag Provisions. And we're most curious how this business can possibly work in this world of rules and regulations. So Daniel, Wild Stag Provisions. What's a stag? Is that a deer?
Wild Stag Provisions. Yeah, it has a nice ring, doesn't it?
It does.
That's really the main reason.
It's much more, you know what it conveys to me? I think of the farms in New Zealand that I saw that harbored wild elk and, or not wild, but free roaming elk and deer. And I realized that they were there because they were going to get eaten. Yes. And that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, the stag is a beautiful image, also from my Austrian ancestry. So I love it. And yeah, Wild Stag Provisions has a very small niche where we are. And of course, regulations press on us just like...
immensely, sure.
Yeah. And one of the common questions I get at the farmer's market is, do you hunt all these animals that you sell? And
of course, we wonder.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah. And there are some regulatory barriers around that. And I think it's important to note that the biggest federal law prohibiting anybody to sell hunted meat to the public is called the Lacey Act. It was formed in the year 1900. And it was to ensure that populations of wildlife come back by taking away any incentive to monetize hunting. Because what was happening during the days of market hunting is they would, hunters would go out for what they call long hunts, right? I mean, when I go for a long hunt, it's 7 days. Back then, it was 2 years. They say, bye wife, bye kids, I'll see you in a couple of years, going long hunting.
And, 2 years?
Oh,
a
yeah.
2 year hunt?
Sure. Yeah, they would go out and they would just hunt a lot of animals, and all with the incentive of making money. And this idea of a buck is selling a deer hide for a buck. And they would go and just load up their wagons and come back and sell it. And at that point, towards the end of the turn of the century, populations were really suffering. So there were just not a lot of elk. Bison, of course, is a historical tale.
Yeah, there's the story right there.
Yeah, but many other animals fell into that as well. And then the Lacey Act came in to prohibit that. So that doesn't allow any monetization or even trading of hunted wildlife. So because of that, all the animals that I that come to me from the ranch that I work with are considered livestock by the USDA.
Right.
So they're not hunted, and they still go through the standard USDA process.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're raised on ranches, and they're slaughtered there.
Yep. And they're slaughtered on site.
On site. And then the carcass is frozen?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, they have a standardized process, the USDA does, and they're frozen on site, it's all there, and then they get distributed, however they get distributed.
So in a sense, you're kind of like a restaurant.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. Yeah, because a restaurant or some butcher shops and myself, we're all bound by the same regulations in the supply chain.
Now, the world of meat is changing dramatically by virtue of the internet and the food that now comes in cardboard boxes to the front door rather than you going to the grocery store and buying it. So that opens up a lot of possibilities for ranchers, farmers, people like Daniel Logner from Wild Stag Provisions to reach markets and just about anywhere.
It does. And in my niche with this kind of wild game or wild animals meat niche that I'm in, it's not very scalable. And I'd like to talk a little bit about why. And
please do.
It's one of
actually... And when we're talking about scalable, yes, that means you're not going to be a McDonald's.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to be distributing... I'm not even going to be distributing throughout California. I'm really community-focused.
So you're really focused on that farmer's market.
Yeah, farmer's market
model. Let's talk about why that is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, partially... one of the philosophies that I have in the business is to be able to provide what I believe is the highest quality meat available to the public outside of hunted meat, to the community, to my community. And so that's one of the philosophies. But I think it's important to think a little bit more about the scalability around utilizing animals like bison, venison, elk, wild boar. This begs a bigger question, which is domestic animals such as cattle, pigs, chicken, etc. They've been bred tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of times with chickens to have specific genetic behavioral traits that lend themselves better to us being consumers. Whereas animals such as bison, elk, venison...
They're wild. They were shortly...
That's right. Exactly. They're closer to their genetic ancestry, so to speak. And because of that, they have different requirements in the field to raise them. And those requirements are that they need a lot more space. They don't feed and stay put like cattle do. Cattle will stay in one spot, eat everything around them, and then move to the next spot. Whereas bison, closely related, will feed and then move and feed and
on
move
the move.
And feed. They're just on the move. Right. And if they encounter a fence, they will move through the fence.
Right.
And that's how they're genetically programmed, which is, well, we don't have to get too deep into that. But it's important.
Well, what it means is you kind of have to go with who they are or what they are rather than trying to stuff them into a feedlot.
Exactly. Yeah. So bison, elk, venison, they don't survive in feedlots. They don't do well with corn. They don't do well with anything except quite natural habitat. And by quite natural, I mean that they have naturally growing food there available and lots of space for them to roam in that area. Anything other than that, and they start suffering, and then you have to treat them with antibiotics or you have to do all kinds of ways to mitigate those issues. So in that way, it's not very scalable because a few animals require a whole lot of land. And then there's a direct relationship between how much meat I can provide to the community and the quality of that meat. So the more meat I want to be able to provide, the less quality the life of those animals are. So in that way, I like to stay with the philosophy of providing this high quality meat to my community here locally, because I know if I stay at that scale, I can still uphold the quality that I believe in is necessary.
So the core issue is that we cannot readily domesticate wild animals and stuff them into industrial settings like we can those animals that with whom we've had this long, long, long relationship, cattle, hogs, chickens. We can stuff them into feedlot facilities that closely resemble cities when it gets right down to it, and treat them like we treat ourselves, which is not very nice when it gets right down to it. Wild animals, different story. They need the space. And so in thinking of those ranches or farms or whatever they call them in New Zealand, they were free to roam, and they roamed.
Yep, they do that at the ranch that I work with in Wyoming. You know, they have 55,000 acres there.
What's the name of the ranch?
Durham.
Okay.
Yep. And they have a beautiful area where they can just freely walk around. Oh. Yeah. And land, I mean, the quantity of land out there is a little bit different than what we have here. The grasslands of northeast Wyoming are quite vast. So 55,000 acres is doable. Here in California, it would be quite difficult to have that kind of land and have it be productive.
For run animals. Out of room really quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, with respect to farmers' markets, you're plunked right down here in a little community within a very big metropolitan community. And we're city people. And when these city people walk up and see wild stag provisions, they go, what? Mm-hmm. And so you have to sell it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you go about approaching a person probably who has never had wild meat before? That's probably a small majority of those people who shop at farmers markets have had wild meat before, maybe fish.
It's certainly niche. I do have to acknowledge that it's somewhat trending right now to have this like hunting wild meat kind of back to ancestry. There's a little bit of a trend there, which is great for me. And when people see my stand at the market.
Wait a minute. Where's that trend coming from? Is it just a rebellion to the plastic wrapped food that we're consuming from the supermarket? Are people finally waking up to the fact that maybe there's something else?
In pockets, I think that's the case. And I wanna believe that the pendulum is swinging a little bit and that there's been a bit of a noticing of the consumption we do and the absolute unsustainable way that we're doing it in. And with it, I also, as controversial figure that he is, Joe Rogan has quite a platform, and he speaks very openly about hunting and the quality of wild meat, and he single-handedly has had a direct influence on a lot of people's opinion around this. So I think it needs to be acknowledged that he has.
They call him influencers for a reason, right?
Indeed.
And he's a big one.
He's a big one, and he speaks very openly about that. And on that topic, I largely agree with him. And
so this kind of goes back to this notion that you're challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The city folk ethic of eating with wild stag provisions.
Absolutely.
As is Joe Rogan.
Yes. I like to think of wild stag provisions as a wild meat supplier, but also as a platform for education. I want to engage people, and I don't push that per se, but I welcome it. And if there are any questions that my customers have, which there are a lot of for good reasons, because my booth says reclaiming the power of wild meat. What does that mean? So I invite questions, and I love that. And I love to engage people and utilize my platform as a place to talk about on a philosophical level, how we consume meat. Where does it come from? And how can we do the best that we can as consumers in a capitalistically driven world? Mm-hmm. And it is very difficult. And again, there is no correct way. And it's important to note that there is deep complexity, history, and nuance. And we just need to become more aware. And that's where it begins. Let's start with this awareness. Let's think critically about where our food comes from, and then make decisions for us and our immediate community. And hopefully from within, things can grow.
A lot of work to be done there, Daniel Logner.
Yes, but it has to start somewhere.
there you go. One person at a time, right?
Yes, indeed.
And there you go. Well, We're going to have to take a quick break here in a couple of minutes, but how much can we do with wild meat? I mean, as you say, there's a limitation here. But as I look out there into the world, there seems to be a lot more that could be done with respect to wild meat. But how much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as large consumption of wild meat, federally, you know, in the country, it's unlikely that that's going to happen. But perhaps there is an awareness and an education of how animals like to live, what's more ethical for them, and, or rather the alternative, what kind of conditions should animals not live in? What kind of meat should I try to avoid and stay away from, and why? And I think those are really important questions to ask. And I would hope that understanding the conditions that wild meat animals live in, bison, elk, and venison, might shed a little bit of light on how far we've come into creating these animals, quite literally, for our consumption.
And the interesting fact is, by hunting animals, you're making it possible for them to live. Now, that would probably be the most difficult thing for a city person to comprehend. But in fact, it is the truth. Hunting them allows them to live. Not hunting them, not allowing them to live. This is the Food Chain. When we come back, we have to ask Daniel how to go about finding and eating wild meat. Gonna be fun. Stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Court ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it.
on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Today, we're thinking about eating some wild meat. Now, I was raised on it, a lot of it, and I miss it, and I hunger for it. I sometimes dream, or daydream actually, about roasting a haunch of buffalo on a campfire on a Montana prairie someplace. And I just get hungry thinking about the juices rolling off that bison meat. But not to be had right now. But we are learning how to come to grips with the fact that we can culture wild meat, which makes them not so wild. Right, Daniel?
Yeah, that's right. They're still livestock. Yeah.
They're still livestock.
Yeah, but closer to their genetic ancestry in that way, not so domestically bred.
Now, is there something in that genetic ancestry, that wildness, that is good for our body?
I believe so. And you can look at this from a very pragmatic standpoint and just look at the fat content and the protein density of bison compared to cattle, and you'll find some really interesting information there.
If we are what we eat, then we are what we eat eats.
Yes.
And if our cattle are eating grain in a feedlot,
yep,
they're a lot different than cattle that are grazing on prairie grasses.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of what you eat there is going to be a lot different in terms of fat content and meat as well, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And the fat content isn't necessarily terrible for people to have, like, fattier meat. It just has to be done in a mindful way. You just don't want to consume that all the time. And so for more of staple meats, you want to have more lean meats. You don't want to be consuming those animal fats every day, as most people do.
So wild stag provisions, the meats you have are generally less fatty.
Yeah, that's right. They're okay. Very, very lean. Most of the meat doesn't have any fat at all.
Okay. Tell us how one should walk up to your booth at the farmer's market and get involved.
Yeah.
What would I order first?
Yeah, sure. Well, we have a whole line of gourmet sausages, mm-hmm, which are really approachable.
So that's probably the easiest, yes, entry point, right? Exactly. Sausages, that's it. Yeah.
Easy to, you know, a lot of the recipes, they, against my better will, but to be able to, have most people approach it, the recipes sort of mask some of the wild flavors of the meat, which can be intimidating for some people. And some people are attracted to those, mm-hmm, especially the ones who have nostalgia or, you know, childhood memories from that.
Well, I have both with respect to the wild meats that I've eaten growing up. And some of the memories are very good, mm-hmm, and some not so good, depending on what the animal had been eating. Now, if the animal had been eating sagebrush, not so good.
Yep, it has a stronger flavor, and especially with deer who are browsers, they eat brush and leaves, yeah, and elk and bison, they're grazers, so they only eat grass, and it can pretty well be assumed that that meat is going to be very neutral in flavor and good, sweet.
So you're probably not going to get sagebrush meat, though.
No, okay. Yeah. So the sausages are really approachable because they're just yummy. Mm-hmm. They're just yummy. I add fat in because the meat is so lean, so right, they're just right, yummy. And then the next step beyond that would be burger. And I have preformed patties, and the meat is such high quality, and it's such a tiny supply chain that you can cook those burgers very rare, and they stay juicy and delicious in that way, even though there's no fat in them.
So you cook them quickly.
Yeah, hot and fast. Yep.
Hot and fast.
Absolutely, yeah. And that allows that meat to stay tender and juicy and doesn't dry out if they get overcooked. Whereas the standard cattle burger with like a 20% fat or 15% fat will stay quite juicy even if it's over, what I would consider overcooked.
Right.
Yeah. So it requires a little bit more finesse, but still quite simple to approach. And then the next step from there, I have very high quality steak cuts that are just going to be tender as long as you cook them hot and fast. And it would be cooked like, you know, perhaps a filet mignon, which is extremely lean, a small cut, and very tender. And if you treat any of the perhaps elk steaks, which I call elk medallions, like that, with hot and fast basic seasonings, and then let it rest and slice it thin, you're going to have a really tender, wonderful cut. Yeah.
Going, oh, food, yes, that sounds so good.
And that's as complicated as my products get. Mm-hmm. I used to have some other things which required a bit more skill in the kitchen. But for right now, everything that I have is very easy to consume. Yeah.
Now, do you do mail order?
I have that option available on my website.
Okay.
And
that's why I asked. I saw it there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All you need to do is go to the website, and you know, you can subscribe to items. You can do however you like. Yeah.
Do you have like a food of the month club or steak of the month club or something like that going?
I don't, but that's a great idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, Harry and David's great model for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, great.
And so it really is important then that you're able to track down the right sources.
It's hugely important. And it took me many, many months when I started Wild Snack Provisions looking through almost every wild meat ranch in the country, as well as Canada and New Zealand, to find the vendors that fit my criteria.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what your customers are really looking for you to do.
Yes.
Is find those the right source.
Absolutely. Yeah, they depend on me to vet the ranch, to make sure that the animals have the
because you know what it want. Took to find them.
Yes.
And nobody else wants to go through that. What do you look for?
Very simple criteria. Simple, not easy. And that's essentially that the animals have growing food so that the natural feed that they need grows there. And that they have plenty of space to roam. That's it. Those are my two main criteria. And if those criteria are met, all the other things fall into place. They don't have high density of populations. So then
they don't have a lot of sicknesses.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of sickness because there's not a high density of population. They, the animals are able to move, so they don't have any kind of physical issues around that. Or
so you're really looking for farms and ranches that proximate as closely as possible nature.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And especially when it comes to Durham Ranch, they're on natural habitat of where the bison used to roam in their ancestry anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have these massive plots that are fenced because they have to be, but the bison don't seem to mind.
Okay, yeah. As long as there's a lot of room to move.
Enough room, enough room, yeah.
And I notice a lot of them are forming cooperatives as well, the bison people and whatnot.
Yes, yeah, there's a big movement in that direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unlike Ted Turner,
unlike
who Ted owns Turner. Half of Montana.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we want to head in this direction where we start thinking about the supply chain not as the massive operations that are ruling the food industry and start
we're in four businesses run 80-90% of the meat in America.
Yes, absolutely. And start creating a little bit more nuance in the supply chain and breaking away from that.
More small people working together
to
form marketable-sized co-op, the classic agriculture classic co-op.
Yep. That will increase quality of land. It will increase quality of the meat. It will increase quality of the people within that co-op. It will just strengthen the community, and it will empower communities as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, all of the slaughter has to go through federal government facilities, correct?
Yes, those can be mobile too.
Ah, okay. Now, that was up to a year or so ago, until very recently, that was the greatest impediment to small-scale animal husbandry, was the difficulty in slaughter and mm-hmm. processing. Mm-hmm. And it's the big industrial-scale operators have figured out a great way of getting rid of all the competition by making it financially impossible for small operators to work. Mm-hmm. Do you see a way of overcoming that obstacle?
This has been ongoing for many years.
Yes.
And the work of Temple Grandin has to be mentioned, who has done an immense...
The Temple Grandin.
Incredible.
Not just any Temple Grandin, but the Temple Grandin.
One of my heroes. Yeah. And what she has done has moved the needle, per se, in how slaughtering happens. Not everywhere, but at least in awareness to most. And I have to say that there just isn't a great solution. There just isn't. The only things that we can do is having the work of Temple Grandin grow, having awareness of what slaughter, like large-scale slaughter facilities do, having awareness around that, and perhaps starting to create a little bit of mitigation around the conditions there. And the only other solution, which I feel lucky that I'm part of, is to minimize the quantity of animals per slaughter at a time. That will start mitigating some of the terrible conditions that can occur. But mm-hmm. when you have thousands of animals in line waiting to be slaughtered, just is awful. There's no way around it.
I have a few minutes left, but I'd like to ask you the big question. As a hunter, what is the first thing you do when you shoot an animal?
This is a deeply philosophical struggle that I have in myself, because I have so much love for animals, and always have, my entire life, since my earliest memories.
Did you pet chickens?
Everything, all the things. I've done all the things.
Fair enough.
I slept in a sea of stuffed animals, and I did all the things. I just absolutely adore all animals. They fascinate me, and I have a kinship with them. The killing part of hunting is unbelievably difficult, and it sometimes takes me weeks to recover emotionally from a hunt, especially if it's a very intimate hunt. And I always inevitably ask myself, why am I doing this again? Why am I out here facing this, this truth of
life and death.
Yes. And the answer is life and death. Yet I could still choose not to do it and not put myself through that pain.
Eat the plastic wrapped meat.
Yes, I could. And that is actually a struggle that I have. I find myself out there sitting in front of a dead animal, sometimes weeping. And then I ask myself, why am I doing this again? And there isn't a clear answer. It's a deep struggle, and I don't think I will ever have a deep answer or a real answer around this, except that I want to be in the cycle of life and death up front, right there. And it also builds a deep knowledge and intimacy with these animals that I love so dearly.
Yeah.
It's an irony, a paradox almost, to want to be involved with animals by killing them, but it is a way for me to have a very close relationship with them.
It is said, I don't know how true it is or not, but it has been said that the Plains Indians always thank the animal when they killed it. Thank them for providing them with life. And I guess, you know, when it gets right down to it, that that seems to be what you're trying to teach the world. It gets right down to it. Whether you're slaughtering an animal or chopping down a soy plant, the same holds true, that we must kill to eat. And if we somehow come to grips with, maybe if we give thanks.
Yeah, I would add something to that, which is the thanks is for me. It's not for the animal. The thanks is the gratitude I have is for myself. And the animal doesn't need gratitude. What the animals need is an awareness of us humans of what they need. The way that we can be thankful, the way that we can have gratitude, is by knowing how they can live a good life.
Well, Daniel Logner, owner and butcher, Wild Stag Provisions. You can find that on the internet, and you'll find him to be one very interesting person with wild food. And fess up, ladies and gentlemen, no matter how cultured and civilized we have become, there's still a little bit of the call of the wild in each and every one of us. Thank you for tuning in. Food Chain Radio Program, Michael Olson with Daniel Logner, Wild Stag Provisions.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.